Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This we call the King of the Wild ER show. We will explain that later in the show.
Because we have to.
Yeah, because after all, it makes no sense. Now, it probably won't make any sense when we explain it.
Since when did we ever make sense?
Yeah, we don't have to make sense. We're Health Matters. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And here to explain to you how to access our nonsense nonstop 24 hours a day on the Wild World of Web, my co-medical host, UK Manager of Communications Infrastructure, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can go listen to the nonsense at WMKY.org. That's right. Morehead State Public Radio's website. You have to find the Health Matters page, and then there's a list of the shows. And this, you probably do need to look at the show summary and see if which little bit of nonsense you're interested in. But if you decide that's what you want to do, you can listen to it right there. You can certainly sign up for the podcast. Have Health Matters delivered to your device automatically. It doesn't happen right after the show. It usually takes about 4 days. So if you do sign up for the podcast, be patient. You'll get the first three or four shows, however you have your device configured. And then you'll get it pretty much 4 or 5 days after the first show airs. You can count on that. After that, you've listened to it. You've got frustrated. It's time to interact. It's time to send us some feedback that lets us know that you just aren't happy. Well, Facebook.com/HM Radio Show. That is provided that Facebook is still around by the time this thing airs because, you know, Facebook's blowing up right now after the election. I realize it's like, what, 7 days after the election or
sure.
10 days, something like that. But still, social media is going nuts. Facebook.com/HM Radio Show is absolutely where you can interact. Leave us some feedback. Leave us your comments. Ask us a question. Give us show topics. Maybe something comes across in the news that you got questions on. Maybe there's just something that you just have a curiosity on. That's how you ask the questions. And believe it or not, Tony and I do actually follow that page. We do actually look at the comments and in most cases try to respond. In some cases, there is no response. But for the most part, you can talk to us. It's what we have the page for. So anyway, look for us, Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, Colon Cancer Screening, reminding you, you screen, I screen, we all screen for colorectal cancer. This is from June 21st, 2016, the AMA Journal. They had a patient page about colorectal cancer. This is cancer of either the colon or large intestine or the rectum, which is the lower part of the large intestine. Mostly affects older adults, although the incidence rates are rising among younger adults. It is the second leading cause of cancer death in the United States behind lung cancer. Symptoms include a change in the bowel habits, that is, you are more constipated than usual, you get diarrhea, you may get some abdominal pain, and blood in the stool is one of the things that we doctors always ask about for this. There are several tests that you can use to check it. Colonoscopy using a scope requiring a prep is the most commonly used one in the United States. You can also do something called flexible sigmoidoscopy using a scope to look at only the lower part of the colon. Does not require a prep, does not require any anesthetic medicines or sedation. CT colonography, virtual colonoscopy with a CAT scanner. This is not approved by Medicare, but it does give an image of the colon. Stool-based test involving either a test for blood, we call that a fecal occult blood test or an FOBT, or a fecal immunochemical test for blood or a stool DNA test. Now, here is this AMA patient page from June 21st. It says, there are pros and cons to each of these tests. Each has its own optimal screening interval. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force does not specifically recommend using one test over another. Remember that because we're going to come back to this in our third and final fractional portion and talk about the problem of not specifically recommending one colon cancer screening test. But that is our sponsor, Colon Cancer Screening. You screen, I screen. We all screen for colon cancer. We had on our Facebook page one of our listeners and one of our fans on Facebook page. Her name is Kat, and she posted, and she had an issue that I wanted to bring up here, and I'm reading from her post. She says, this issue is people who work but truly cannot afford health insurance who then cannot get health care. She says, I've read estimates of so many thousand die in the U.S., but they can't get things like cancer care. Now, how many thousand die? Well, that's a tough thing to get to. There was a report June 2012 by Families USA USA called Dying for Coverage, The Deadly Consequences of Being Uninsured. And they figured out that about 2,175 people die prematurely every month because they didn't have insurance as of 2010. The Affordable Care Act was not fully in force at that time. So we're talking about somewhere between 20 and 26,000 people a year at that time before the Affordable Care Act died of because they were not able to access proper care because they did not have insurance. When you look at the state totals, the state of Kentucky lost, their estimates were 436 people who died due to lack of insurance. So Kat says, what about those people, those 26,000 nationally, those 400 and change in the state of Kentucky? Now, the Affordable Care Act, I have not seen any estimates of how many people died due to lack of insurance. Now, we believe that it is substantially lower. We are now in a state of flux, so it may go up again. But what about those people? And my answer to Kat is rather complicated, and it starts with the King of the Wild ER. Now, let's go back to the 1950s. This was around 1952 or so. Walt Disney was not doing too well with his film empire, but he started thinking about creating Disneyland in California. He had been to Tivoli Gardens in Copenhagen. He got some bank funding, and then he went to the American Broadcasting Company, that's ABC, and he asked them if they would spot him some money to help build his Disneyland. In return, he would do a weekly TV show that then it spun off. And he also had the Mickey Mouse Club and some other things. But when he started his show, he broadcast a four-part series on Davy Crockett, and it was Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier. So that's how I got King of the Wild ER.
Didn't they have a little jingle? I'm surprised you're not singing it.
Davy.
That's Davy Crockett. Sorry I mentioned
King
it.
King of the Wild Frontier. Well, and this, by the way, this made the career of a young and very handsome 6'4" Fess Parker. He was the George Clooney of his day. He became Davy Crockett. He went on to star in a TV series called Daniel Boone. And the last line from the Daniel Boone song was, "What a boon, what a doer, what a dream come a truer was he." And, you know, I think of myself as a dream come a truer, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, people have said that to me. You know, Tony, you are, in fact, a dream come a truer. And I generally tend to just blush because I am a modest person. But back to Davy Crockett. This thing took off. There were four versions of the Davy Crockett song, including one version in French that even recently the Kentucky Headhunters re-recorded that song. It was an absolute smash hit. All the kids bought coonskin caps. I was around in the 1960s when they re-aired those, and the whole thing started up again. And we got our ideas of the frontier, of cowboys and Indians and all that stuff from these Davy Crockett shows. Now, the reason I mention this, and you're thinking about Kat and her problem, her concern about people that don't have insurance. I believe whether it is the Affordable Care Act, whether it is the Trump alternative, whether it is a universal single-payer health care, we cannot, in my mind, afford any of these plans until we give up our infatuation with high-tech, high-cost, low-value health care. Our country is so crazy that you have to actually write down that you don't want to be put on a machine before you die. You are an elderly person. You have lived a long life. You have to make sure that you sign a paper saying, don't put me on a machine, or you get put on a machine. We do so many things like that that do not make people happy, do not prolong their joy, but try to give them a few extra days at an immense cost. Most of the medical costs, in fact, occur during the last 6 months of life, and they don't tend to make people happier. And meanwhile, we ignore the vast amount of health care that we could provide that would improve people's lives, including those people that don't currently have insurance. So, you know, you think about Davy Crockett and the coonskin cap. I'm showing you the emergency room shows, the trauma surgery shows, all these TV shows that concentrate on those heroic high-tech efforts. Research, you got to get this brain tumor out in 30 seconds or the eyeball will explode, all this kind of stuff, when the vast majority of health care is very boring. It's about getting people to change their lives. And so as long as we're buying our coonskin caps and we're dressing up in scrubs and we're watching these shows and we think that machines are our salvation, no health care plan is going to work. We're never going to be able to insure those people.
But Tony, that's the misnomer. I mean, you and I, granted, albeit I've been out of healthcare for a while, right? So I still am around healthcare from a peripheral standpoint. So no, I'm still around. And obviously, I'm still married into an active practicing physician. This is a misnomer that the outside the hospital, people believe the Davy Crockett mentality that there's some excitement going on and we're all out, you know, we're exploring the Wild West with this. But really, inside healthcare, it really is kind of nose to the grindstone, kind of keep your head down, see the patients, try to make everything. So, I mean, really, there's two different perspectives here. The perspective is, are you in and around healthcare or are you outside of healthcare?
The vast majority of healthcare, I believe, could be delivered for a fraction of the cost that we're currently requiring. If we could dial back this high-tech thing. And yet, we have an insatiable appetite for this. I don't think we can do it.
I think it's more than just an insatiable appetite. I think, first, we are an industrialized nation, right? We grew out of, some of the greatest times in our nation were the advent of the automobile, the advent of the light bulb. I mean, we have basically industrialized the entire society. So stands to reason, we're going to keep wanting to move in that direction. And all that means today is high tech, faster apps, better mobility. It translates into cell phones and all the various things that surround that, the drones, all the high tech in healthcare.
Yeah, I understand. Robotic surgery, for instance, you get a robotic assistant.
But there's also one element to this, right? If you can build a better mousetrap, and we have the technology and we're moving in that direction to build that better mousetrap, or possibly it's still in the build process, there's a legal component to all of this that there is somewhat of an unwritten force that says you have to try everything you possibly can to do what's right for the patient, right? Or otherwise, you don't meet a community of practice or a standard of care, and thus you open yourself up to some legal issues. So I think there's a whole lot to this conversation.
Right. Now, when you say everything you can, you mean every machine in the hospital. And I'm not trying to box you in.
No.
But I understand.
I mean, every tool or trick or test or whatever I have at my disposal.
Except behavioral change and prevention. You know, you don't get sued for not preventing things. We're going to talk in our next fractional portion about, consumption of sodas and sugar and how we could do something there that would actually improve health, save lives, and so forth. It's not glamorous. It's not high tech. You're right. We have to do everything heroic, but some of this stuff is not heroic, and that's the stuff, in my mind, we're ignoring, and that's the stuff where I think we could really improve health.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not sure that I think if, and when we're doing problem solving, right? You ever heard the term go after the low hanging fruit? I'm not sure that's the low hanging fruit because it's the hardest thing to do. And so thus, an MRI is easier than telling me to quit eating ice cream.
You have a point. Yeah. Well, you think about it.
And I really like ice cream.
I understand.
More than
Great stuff. But I am convinced that we will bankrupt any system, any healthcare system we put out there. We could import the Canadian system, the British system. We could use the Affordable Care Act. We could expand Medicare. Any one of those systems, we will bankrupt unless we change our approach to health and healthcare. I'm just thinking out loud here. This is a post-election thought, I'm sure. Meanwhile, we have blown the entire first fractional portion. Please stay tuned. We're going to talk about something important in our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Hello, and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the King of the Wild ER show. It is our dismay, I guess.
Master Nonsense Distributor.
Yeah.
That's your new title.
I don't know what that means. I have no idea what that means. The point is, we have right now the ability to derail any healthcare system that we put in place because we have these unrealistic expectations of what to do at the very end of a disease or at the very end of our lives, and we don't do enough up front. So we comparing it to the Davy Crockett craze that swept the country in the 1950s, maybe it's not an apt comparison. I was just listening to that and reading about that the other day and thought that's really the way we feel about our healthcare right now. We have heroic figures. We have our own Fess Parkers standing by in the emergency room waiting to do CPR because we did not do simple things like take care of our blood pressure and our cholesterol. That's all I'm going to say about that. Kat, thanks for your comments. I know that's not the answer you want. We don't know how many people died due to lack of insurance, but it still was a problem. I'm here to tell you, from the free clinics, it still was a problem even with Medicaid expansion. On the other hand, Medicaid expansion did a wonderful thing in eastern Kentucky. It gave a lot of people access to health care that had not had it before. I'm hoping that through all of the post-election changes, we will somehow be able to hang on to at least some of the wonderful things that Medicaid expansion brought to the Appalachian Mountains in Kentucky. Our sponsor for the second time, before we do that, let's just say a word about Shelley Irving. Shelley, you may remember, has been sitting in on our program. Shelley is assistant professor with the University of Kentucky College of Health Sciences PA Studies program. Shelley, as you may have noticed, is a rather quiet and reserved person, loves sitting in on the radio show. We're bringing her along. Shelley had to take today off, but she will be back. We did not fire her, nor did we scare her off. She is made of sterner stuff than that.
You say that now, but she's enjoying a night away from us, and that's probably a good thing.
Probably better than last week, but at any rate, we'll not talk about that further. Our sponsor, colon cancer screening. You screen, I screen, we all screen for colon cancer. Colon and rectal cancer, says the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and the American Cancer Society, beginning age 50. Age 50. This is when life gets a little bit darker. Both men and women, average risk for developing cancer of the colon, should use one of the screening tests I will describe below or afterwards. These can detect cancer. Some of them can detect also polyps, which turn into cancer. The tests that find polyps in cancer, a flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years, a colonoscopy every 10 years, a barium enema every 5 years. Nobody does that anymore, but it's still on the list. A CAT scan of the colon called a virtual colonoscopy every 5 years. Medicare doesn't pay for it. It's rather expensive. It's also a pretty hefty dose of radiation. We at Health Matters do not recommend it. Tests that mainly find cancer, a stool blood test every year, a stool immunochemical test, they call that a FIT test, every year, but it's still a stool sample, and then finally a stool DNA test, and we're not sure how often to do that, but right now I think people are doing it. It's more expensive than the stool blood test, so people are doing it somewhere between 1 and 5 years. If you have a higher risk, this is if you've had a personal history of cancer or polyps, they call them adenomatous polyps. If you have a history of inflammatory bowel disease like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, if there's a family history of cancer, polyps, in somebody younger than age 60, if there's a family history of some hereditary colorectal cancer syndromes, then you will need to talk with your doctor about screening, a different method of screening. But we do recommend all Americans over age 50 who are at average risk begin their screening for colon and rectal cancer using one of those tests. Now, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force did not recommend one test over the other. Again, in our next fractional portion, that brought up some response from the European colorectal cancer screening experts. We'll talk about that in our third fractional portion, and that, in fact, is how that got to be our sponsor. Now, we talked about then the low-tech things. What do you do instead of getting George Clooney or Fess Parker or whoever your hero is to come in and shock your heart after you've already bled to death? This is low-tech. This is November 4th, 2016. It's called the Public Library of Science Medicine. Was actually published November 1st by Kirsten Bibbins Domingo, Department of Medicine, University of California, San Francisco. She was studying the 10% tax on sugar-sweetened beverages in Mexico. It was introduced in 2014, obviously a lot of opposition from the industry. Mexico at that time had the highest consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages in the world, 43 gallons per person per year. Now, the U.S. consumption, since the late 1990s, it peaked at 53 gallons in 1998 and dropped to 41 gallons by 2014.
Is that because of the invent of diet? Diet became more popular and it lowered it, or does it not? Because it doesn't count in the total, right?
Right. No, in fact, the whole soft drink industry has collapsed somewhat. Kids are drinking water.
You don't think it's diversity? You don't think there's too much to drink? There's juices, there's teas, there's Red Bull, there's, you know.
Those other things have certainly, there are a lot of other options, but all I can tell you is that soft drink consumption has dropped noticeably. However, again, U.S. per capita is at 41. Mexico's was at 43 when they introduced the tax. Appalachia, the Appalachian Mountain chain in those states, has the highest per capita consumption of soft drinks in the U.S. And so ours is, if the average is 41 gallons per capita in 2014, ours is going to be at least at Mexican levels of sugar-sweetened beverage consumption. Now, using estimates, this is what they Kirsten Bibbins Domingo and the folks at the University of California, San Francisco did. They first of all, they figured out, well, from the Framingham Heart Study, from those numbers, what is the risk of having a heart attack or a stroke if you are 30 to 90 years old or so. You're taking into account your cholesterol levels, your body mass index, and whether or not you have diabetes. And then they said, well, what's the risk of having diabetes? And then they asked what from the Mexican population, and they used a Mexican National Health and Nutrition Survey to figure out how much of the daily calories of the average Mexican came from sugar-sweetened beverages. And then they looked at what happens when you put a 10% excise tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. What they found was a population reduction of 10% in sugar-sweetened beverages would lead to a reduction in new cases of diabetes of 189,000, 20,000 fewer strokes and heart attacks, and almost it's 18,900 fewer deaths per year. The greatest impact, people aged 35 to 40 years. So they modeled that based on what the consumption was among the Mexicans and before and after the tax was implemented. And they used Framingham data to figure out what that meant. Now, if you also, this was November 4th, same day. This was in the BMJ, formerly the British Medical Journal, and they're talking about the tax that was in place with the U.S. City of Berkeley, California. The consumption of soda and sugared beverages in low-income neighborhoods fell 21% after they imposed a penny-per-ounce tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. It was more than double. They thought it might get 10%. They instead got 21% reduction. It was passed in November 2014, implemented in March 2015. They were able to look at then at from March 2015 through March of 2016, and they found a 21% reduction. At the 21% reduction level, we are talking about a significant savings in terms of stroke, heart attack, and lives based on a soda tax.
In that one city.
And Berkeley, California is not a hotbed of soda consumption. We are. The savings of life, the prevention of diabetes, the number of heart attacks prevented in eastern Kentucky would easily exceed those that they calculated in Mexico, and would easily, if we could get those numbers down by 21% by putting a penny an ounce tax on our soft drinks in eastern Kentucky, it could be fabulous.
So this obviously, you know, we're talking about it now, post-election, people in California obviously were aware of it because three other cities in California voted this exact same one penny per ounce tax in.
Yeah, I know you were talking about that before the show. Where did it get voted in, Rick?
San Francisco, Oakland, which obviously is part of Berkeley. I mean, it's right next to Berkeley, and Albany, California. And then also, as a side note, Boulder, Colorado. But yeah, but we're talking about California here.
I understand. And think about that for a minute. Again, we have the highest rate of soft drink consumption in the United States here in the Appalachian Mountains. We also have, we're in the top 10 in obesity rate.
Can we agree that soda is a luxury? Can we agree that I don't drink soda because I have to? I drink soda because I want to, right?
Right.
So by putting a penny an ounce tax on, you've basically not only used it as a deterrent to help our health, overall health, which would lower healthcare costs, you've also created a pool of money. And as much as I'm not a tax guy, you know, now all of a sudden, it's almost like the lottery and the education, right? The lottery is probably not some people's best idea for how to spend your money. But you know what? The lottery system has put an awful lot of money into Kentucky education, right? It's funded an awful lot of scholarships. I think it's paid for some of the Keys program, which gives every high school student a college stipend, basically, for portions of their college tuition. So I'm kind of seeing something similar to that. I think, you know, in Kentucky, we could really benefit if somebody could get a thing like this through, again, because it's a luxury tax. It's you know, the people probably, it's not a fond thing to talk about, but in this particular case, it's so tied to Kentucky health, and Kentucky has such poor health overall. I'm almost willing to put my tax, you know, burden aside and say this is probably a good idea.
It's going to be heavily opposed by the soft drink industry. But, Rick, I really agree with you exactly the way you set it up. That is, no one is going to, in fact, have their joy diminished by the fact they can't have access to soft drinks that cost a penny less an ounce. That's ridiculous. So we're not
now,
depriving anyone.
I might quit drinking them 24 ounces at a time.
You pay a quarter extra for your soft drink. Nobody's going to get hurt by that. And you mentioned the lottery. I'm not as fond of the lottery as you are. I understand.
I'm not fond of it either. I don't play.
Yeah, but in that sense, there is. We know that there are some people who have problems with gambling, dependence, gambling addiction, whatever you want to call it. It also preferentially taxes poor people without offering them any particular benefit.
Now,
yes, there is a scholarship.
I need a disclaimer here. I only play the lottery when it gets up into like the $400 million range, right? right?
Enough. Yeah, if you're going to do something impossible, let's make it worthwhile.
If I want to hit the jackpot, I really want to hit the jackpot.
I understand. I'd be satisfied with $50 million.
You're telling me you've never put in on an office pool for lottery tickets?
I have never put in an office pool for lottery tickets, Rick.
My goodness. You have lived a sheltered life.
I still have. I have my dignity.
Barely.
Back to this. The soda tax, though, in addition to raising money, and if you want to put it to school, put it for schools and education, that's absolutely fine. What they did in Berkeley, as I recall, they put it for anti-obesity programs. So you could marry those two. You could say, all right, we want to prevent obesity in our school system. We want to provide money for school programs to combat obesity. That's fine. But for whatever reason, you get the health benefits on the top end of this thing because you discourage the use of sodas, particularly among people that have very limited incomes and shouldn't be buying them anyway. You get the benefit on the back end, you're right, of some tax dollars that no one is going to feel particularly bad about. You're not going to target any particular group and say, we're going to remove your joy of life, or we're going to compromise your health, your income, and your ability to generate income because of this. As you said, it's strictly an elective decision. I like this idea. We're starting to recognize now that sugar is playing a much larger role in our problem with heart disease and stroke than we thought. We really laid all of this on cholesterol and triglycerides and saturated fats, and we're finding that sugar really is an important actor as well. And we've been giving it a pass, and we've been drinking it by the gallon, literally by the gallon. And so it's time, I think, for a reckoning here. I'd love to see this. It's not going to happen. We have a Republican governor, Republican Congress.
Yeah, what do you say about that? First time in 95 years in Kentucky we've got a Republican House.
So there will be no new taxes. But I think still we need to start the debate, because at some point this could be an important part of our health. It also could be possibly a part of our financial structure. I'm not saying. But at any rate, it worked in Mexico very well. It dropped their consumption substantially. It's worked in Berkeley. It's dropped their consumption. You're seeing these California cities signing on, and I think this will sweep the nation. It will be a healthy way to lower our rate of dependence on sodas and sugar-sweetened beverages. Next up, another thing that factored in the election, and this was before the election, again, this was from the American Medical Association Journal. This was November 1st. They're talking about monitoring marijuana use in the United States. And some numbers here, this again was before the recent election, in which it was legalized recreationally in a number of states. Mm-hmm. In 2014, we had about 22 million Americans 12 years or older use marijuana in the past month. Over the last two decades, more than half of states have allowed some limited access to marijuana or its components for medical reasons. Currently, evidence for therapeutic benefits of marijuana are limited to health conditions such as chronic pain, spasticity, and nausea. The science behind marijuana is not good. Not that marijuana doesn't work, simply we don't know, because we have not had access to marijuana to study it. It's a bizarre situation we're in. We are essentially... we're making it available recreationally before we really know either the side effects or benefits. We do know that the prescriptions for all types of painkillers drop after states legalize marijuana. We don't know, and at least early on, marijuana doesn't seem to be associated with a rise in motor vehicle crashes. There are some things that seem to be good. I don't think we've seen the full burden of the side effects of marijuana for reasons I've explained before. We're still in this very primitive roll-your-own stage, and I think we're going to develop some very, very efficient ways to deliver marijuana. But at any rate, this article was really about talking about access and talking about use of marijuana. If you look between the years of 2002 to 2014, the use of marijuana, current use of marijuana, increased from 4% of the population to 6.6%. That's a pretty substantial increase. Estimates from databases suggest that in 2014, 2.5 million people aged 12 or older used marijuana for the first time within the past 12 months. That's about 7,000 new users a day, and that's about 1,000 more per day than it was back in 2002. During 2002 and 2014, the prevalence of marijuana use in the past month, in the past year, and daily increased among people ages 18 or older, but not among those 12 to 17, not among the high school kids. That is, we're mostly seeing now, as it becomes legalized, people 18 and older using it, which is good. The problem is we don't really have in their minds, strong enough monitoring. We don't know any information regarding the mode of use, whether it was smoked, dabbed, vaped, eaten, or drunk, the frequency of use, the potency of the marijuana consumed, and the reasons for its use. And then the other thing is we really don't have very strong safeguards in place to make sure that it is not used in early in life when the brain is developing and there may be a greater risk of marijuana use. So as we, I think we're pivoting here from the idea that this is a criminal thing to do.
Right.
We've given up on that. It certainly has not worked. A lot of states now are legalizing recreational use. At this point, we have to, though, attend to the safety of younger people and try to put at least the same safeguards we have for alcohol. I'd like to see better safeguards than for alcohol, but right now I don't think we have even that. And the other thing is we're going to have to study this at some point. We've got to find a way that we can do the science and let the science catch up.
Don't you think, though, that the states that have legalized, I mean, that's going to open themselves up to the initial – I mean, we've even reported on some of the initial research that's starting in Colorado. So, I mean, now we just – you know, we've just had a few states. I think it's either three or five. I haven't really looked to see how many it is. But and the funny thing is there was, I think, four states with medical marijuana, I think five states with recreational. I think Arizona kicked the recreational to the curb. I don't think they passed it. And I think in Maine it's still a little too close to call as of this recording. But, you know, all things being said, I think we're going to see a lot of research happen in those areas to start answering some of your questions, Tony.
Yeah, and for me,
that itself isn't a bad thing.
No, at least for once in my adult life, Kentucky does not leading the way in sticking unknown chemicals into our systems without understanding how it's going to affect
us. Unless it's Red Bull.
But you know, the fact is the marijuana is going to be more in the mountain states and along the West Coast. Both the benefits and the side effects are going to be studied there. And once again, it's a typical U.S. uncontrolled, let's all try it and then see whether it's dangerous or not kind of experiment.
It'll be interesting. Now that you got many more states getting into the act, it'll be interesting to see what it does to automobile accidents, the whole nine yards.
Right. And what I'm waiting for is actually when manufacturers begin manufacturing marijuana cigarettes, because that's what, in my mind, is going to really turn things. If they are made, if you have a pack of marijuana cigarettes as opposed to some papers and some leaves, that is a whole different proposition.
More to talk about there. Wish we had time.
Yeah, I know. We're running out of time rapidly in our second fractional portion, but we have one more exciting fractional portion ahead. Stay tuned for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the King of the Wild ER show. Again, our premise for this show is we have gone nuts over high-tech healthcare in the same way that the U.S. went nuts over Davy Crockett after the Walt Disney series in the middle of the 1950s. And this was Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier. We did Davy Crockett, or we did King of the Wild ER show to emphasize that part. It was our answer to Kat when she asked, what about those people are uninsured? We feel that with any system, absolutely any system, we have the ability to bankrupt the system with our entrepreneurial nature combined with the fact that we are absolutely infatuated with high-tech, high-cost, low-yield procedures. And in fact, our TV shows are rife. Every medical show has these excessive procedures being done with and in the show, of course, great positive outcomes. But in fact, this is not the way medicine is practiced. And unfortunately, the combined effect of the TV shows, the combined effect of our desire to rescue and to save people rather than prevent the condition from starting in the first place leaves us in a position where no healthcare system, in our opinion, really will work for the American public. What do we have to do? Well, I thought, my answer to Kat was, well, look, the high deductible, she said, I don't think high deductibles work. I said, oh, yes, they will. Again, if you put a high enough deductible, it causes pain and people have to really think hard about what does and what doesn't work. What I did not think about was the pharmaceutical industry will pay the deductible so that you don't have the pain in order to access the insurance dollars. So in fact, even a high deductible right now, I can pay your deductible and I get access to the insurance money. It's a small down payment. It's well worth it for me as a pharmaceutical person or as a provider of healthcare services. I need to get to that insurance dollars. I don't mind paying your high deductible to get there. So I'm not even sure high deductibles will work as long as we allow that secondary payment of the deductibles. Once again, you have no incentive whatsoever not to use these services if the people providing them will pay your deductible. That's the name of our show, King of the Wild ER. Our sponsor for the final time, colon cancer, reminding you, you screen, I screen, we all screen for colon cancer. Now, I mentioned I've been really teasing this third fractional portion. This was the 8th of November. It was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And the title, which I love, it was America, We Are Confused, the updated U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendation on colorectal cancer screening. It came from Oslo, Norway, Warsaw, Poland, Rome, Italy, Barcelona, Spain, and Stockholm, Sweden. Leading cancer specialists in the European Union are saying we are confused. Now, this was not about the election. It was written before the election, published afterwards. And this is what they said. We're surprised by the latest update of recommendations for colorectal cancer. That's the June recommendations I have read to you. It says, contrary to the principles of evidence-based medicine, the guidelines provided equally strong recommendations for the tests with very different quality of evidence for benefits and harms. Five of the seven strategies recommended by the Preventive Services Task Force. That's colonoscopy, fecal immunochemical testing, for occult blood, computed tomography, virtual colonoscopy, we call that, fecal immunoDNA testing, and the combination of sigmoidoscopy and annual blood testing have not been subjected to clinical effectiveness trials. But they are every bit as strongly recommended as the two that have performed favorably in these trials, that is, stool testing for blood and sigmoidoscopy alone. And they go on to say, you know, why, if you think you are being scientific about it, why do you recommend all these tests equally? And I will tell you, we at Health Matters have recommended colonoscopy for some time because you can't get a sigmoidoscopy. These tests, the insurance companies do not pay well for them, and so most practitioners have simply stopped doing them. You can't get them. You can do the once-a-year stool blood test. We argued that if that test ever turns positive for any reason, you're going to get the colonoscopy, so why not just go ahead and get the colonoscopy? Again, this was a bit of logic we put together. Colonoscopy finds polyps. Finding polyps is the way you prevent cancer, so why not do the colonoscopy? The Europeans are saying, you didn't prove that. Why are you recommending all these tests the same when some of them, the sigmoidoscopy, is proved, the colonoscopy is not? And I brought this in again to point out we love high tech. Colonoscopy is high tech. You look at the entire colon. Sigmoidoscopy does very well, but it's lower tech. You don't need a GI specialist to do it. We won't do it. We're still holding to our stance that colonoscopy is probably the best test to test right now. We're watching the stool DNA. We believe that that will probably be a very good test in the future and maybe a little bit cheaper than the colonoscopy. The European Union doctors have a point, but unfortunately, in our current situation, you cannot get a sigmoidoscopy in the United States. That is our sponsor, colorectal cancer screening, reminding you, beginning age 50 for people at average risk, you screen, I screen, we all screen for colon cancer. Rick, you probably don't remember the movie Surrogates, Bruce Willis,
yes,
2009.
Yeah.
People live their lives
through clones kind of things, these little models, these robots.
Robots. You're absolutely right. This was the 29th October issue of New Scientist, and it got me thinking. There is a project called the VEER Project, V-E-R-E Project, and what they're trying to do is dissolve the boundary between human body and surrogates, giving people the illusion their surrogates are, in fact, their own body. In 2012, they took functional MRI scans of the brains of volunteers while they thought about moving their hands or legs. They measured the changes in blood flow of the brain area. They passed these instructions on to a robot. So essentially, they could remind you of what your functional MRI looked like, and they could make the robot move to your thoughts. It was rather clunky and clumsy, but you could move the robot. They got better at this. This is what I like. A second team, they had a similar setup with people who are paralyzed either from the neck down or from the trunk down. These are quadriplegics and paraplegics, and they are in Italy. They are in Rome, Italy. Instead of using the MRI scanner, which is very elegant, they just put on an EEG, a brainwave cap. And they said, all right, here's four arrows. One goes forward, one back, one left, and one right. They're flashing at different rates. concentrate on the arrow you want to go. And the brainwave then starts flashing at whatever rate that arrow flashes.
Nice.
So that's isn't that genius, yeah. Honestly? Four arrows, different flashing rates. All I got to do is watch your brainwaves and see how fast the EEG tracing is flashing, and I know which arrow you're looking at. They sent that message from Italy to Tsukuba, Japan, where there was a robot. And they were able to move, using these arrows, move the robot across the room. And they got the robot to pick up a drink, move across the room, and put the drink on a table. And it only took 6 minutes of training because, again, it's very simple.
Right.
Put on the cap, look at the arrows, move this thing. A couple of interesting things. First of all, they really did not relate to the robot when it was standing still. Once it started moving and they got the visual feedback, obviously they related more. They found that being silent or just giving beeps didn't help you, so they put footsteps in. So when you look at the forward arrow, yeah, you get the sound of footsteps, and there goes the robot across the room.
Wow.
That's pretty neat. And then they said they tried social interactions. They got people in Italy to play a chess-like game with a robot against an opponent in Munich, Germany. They said, what will happen to a person who cannot move in real life after they use this technology intensively? Will they still feel isolated or lonely? Or, in fact, can we put them back into society? You know, I mean, let's just expand that for a minute, Rick, and think about that. If you have a person who's disabled, they are paralyzed from the neck down to the waist down. They have a robot. They still have a functioning brain, a perfectly right. functioning brain. They have a robot, and they get good at moving this robot and doing tasks with this robot. At that point, the robot could, in fact, go to work for them. The robot could earn them money. The robot could do whatever robots do, whatever people do, because there is a sentient human brain driving this robot.
I mean, I think, you know, there's an awful lot of learning that has to occur for that to be able to happen. I mean, right now you're talking about, does the robot go fast or does the robot go slow? You're not really talking about, does the robot go over to then get an egg out and cook a 3-egg omelet? You know, I mean, I think while this is pretty cool, it's a long way off.
Yes.
It's a long way off. And so to think like that, the movie Surrogates is kind of just, you know, there are things where that would be kind of cool. If you were in a high-risk job, like a coal miner or, you're doing something that's, you know, deadly, you know, then, yeah, I could see doing that. That would be kind of cool. I don't know. There's an awful lot of things that my brain does that it'd be hard to teach something how to do that.
I absolutely agree. It's in its infancy. But
and even with my small brain, as I'm told.
Right. But I don't know why I said right, but I did. I absolutely
agree. Well, you're the one who told me.
Yeah, I know. But you're right.
So you're going to have a much harder time training your surrogate.
And this sounds absolutely horrendous, but let me just say it. What if we then got the quadriplegics, the paraplegics, and their robots to do those hazardous tasks?
You absolutely could. You absolutely could. And I'm not – and please don't read into that. I'm not trying to say that that we shouldn't proceed with this. I mean, this would be a marvelous way to give a better quality of life maybe to somebody who's been, you know, paralyzed and kind of doesn't get the benefit of that movement, right? So you could give them back that experience again, which I think would be great. And then there is the added benefit. Maybe they could go do some work, even if it was as simple as a pair of fingers that they could sit and type at a keyboard, right? So even if they could associate, I want to type an A, I want to type a B, you know, and they could, I mean, just something as simple as being able to type an email, you know, for me sounds like pretty amazing.
Again, functioning part of society, which is right now is very difficult to do. If you have particularly quadriplegia, it's very difficult to do. And yet you have a functioning brain. We can't give you a new body yet. We're working on that. Right. But the other possibility is we could give you a surrogate body.
And I suspect with the way that, I mean, just in the last 3 years, voice recognition technology has gotten so good that, I mean, I can tell my phone who to text, what to text, how to text. I've basically, you know, I remember when I first started in healthcare, you'd see doctors walking around with their little handheld microtape dictaphones, right? And so they're constantly dictating their lab reports or their notes or their ops or whatever it is. And then those tapes find their way back to somebody and they listen and type them up. Nowadays, you don't even have to go to the type phase, right? You just talk into it and it generates that. So when I look at that and think, how much better has voice technology gotten? Couple that with this type of technology. Now, all of a sudden, you could put the two together. And, yeah, maybe you can't do everything, but you can at least talk through the, what you can't actually tell your brain to do.
Well, it represents a different way to go. You know, we
absolutely.
You've seen, and you have the phone now that has the virtual reality. You can remove yourself from the world. You put on those glasses, and you're in some world that I don't even know anything about, and you're doing fantastic things in virtual reality.
So here is my question to you, Tony. Now, you got to put your thinking cap on and really kind of dig in.
Put my EEG cap on, and I'm looking at the arrow.
Dig into this question and think about it. What would you rather have? A car that drives itself, or a car that's driven by somebody using this technology?
Oh, so my Uber guy is actually
your
sitting
Uber
in Rome.
Uber guy is sitting at home. So what would you rather have?
All right. Well, there are layers to this. Let's look through this. Let's talk through the layers. First of all, I asked you one time, if you could get a burger made by a robot or a burger made by a human, which one would you get? And the burger made by the robot would be cheaper. And your question, your answer back to me was just classic Rick. Completely missed the point. You said, is it an American robot? Because I think you're...
I didn't say American. I didn't say that.
That's
now you're painting.
That's
you're painting with a broad brush,
no,
right?
But you're thinking, okay, I am not putting anybody out of a job because for the burger flipper that I made unemployed,
right.
I've got a robot tech guy.
I'm not putting the Uber driver out,
right? So, well, there's my first thought. If I get my driver's in Rome, at least a human being is being employed to drive his car. So that's one for that. On the other hand, this guy in Rome may be mad. He may be having a bad day. This robot is not having
a bad day. Or he's been hacked.
Yeah.
Or he's been hacked.
Now, wait a second. Now, that's going to go both ways, though. If I have a self-driving car, it could easily be hacked as well. I don't see there's any difference there. The security issue is going to be there no matter what, right?
Sure, but I've got a false sense of security in the fact that I think I'm talking to John and it's really, you know, Bill.
Or it's
the car
or
is just not doing what I'm telling it.
So I can't see security. I can see then human employment. And I don't know where I'm going to come down on this, but I think as we get more robotic, I sort of want human beings to be employed. I don't want to put people out of work if I can help it.
Ooh, your airline pilot.
Yeah.
Do you want your airline pilot to be back at ground? I kind of want him committed. I kind of want him in the plane with me, so he's a little committed to the success of the flight.
Got some skin in the game, as they say. I think we're going to see both those circumstances. What I am fascinated by, as I mentioned, is you can either escape from this world in virtual reality, or you can come back to the world in real reality by having essentially an avatar that does the work for you. And so I see an entirely different way to go. To me, the problem with virtual reality was always that although I understand you can get a group of friends from all over the world to come together and try to attack the tank of the opposing 11-year-old.
Killer Dragon. Killer Dragon.
Killer Dragon. That'd be fine. So you in fact, can team up with other people, but by the same token, you're retreating from the world that's actually physically around you. This puts people who can't get into the physical world back into the physical world. And so, to me, these two technologies are exactly opposite, and I'm fascinated by that.
So I got one more question for you.
Yeah.
So if you take your surrogate and you clean the house, are you as tired as if you just cleaned the house? Are you mentally as drained? Does your mental tired make you as tired as your physical tired of cleaning the house?
We're gonna have to deal with mental fatigue, aren't we?
Yeah.
Because, frankly, when I look at screens, I get mentally fatigued. I work very hard with sometimes not leaving the chair.
Absolutely.
And so we're going to have to figure that out. I'll give you another one that I thought about. What if there's a robot basketball association?
Nice.
That's right. You and me.
No dunking allowed.
Going up against LeBron James with our surrogates. If we can look at those flashing arrows fast enough, I'm going to look at the right arrow and then I'm going to go up with a left arrow, and I'm going to leave your robotic jock strap on the floor.
I could take a charge better than it. I mean, as big as mine will be, I'd take a good charge.
Well, it gives, you know, we're going to be, I think all these futures are quite possible and actually very workable. What isn't possible, what isn't workable, is for Health Matters to stay on the air. We've got to get off the air, Rick.
Man, we really, really chewed up that segment. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote a Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org, or just visit us on Facebook. Do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show, and remember,
used along with diet and exercise, Health Matters is the first of a new class of diabetes medicines that's proven to significantly lower your sugar if you have type 2 diabetes.
The most common side effects of Health Matters include genital yeast infections, urinary tract infections, and changes in urination.
Health Matters is not for weight loss, but may help you lose weight, on average 3%. Results may vary by show and when used with certain other radio shows.
Health Matters works with your kidneys to help you lose some sugar through the process of urination.
The
process of urination.
Now I know why people don't like Health Matters.
Can cause some people to become dehydrated due to the loss of too much body water, which may make you feel dizzy, faint, lightheaded, or weak, especially when you stand up.
You may be at higher risk of dehydration if you have low blood sugar, take medicines to lower your blood pressure, have kidney problems, or are 65 years of age or older.
Whatever you do, not take the stuff lying down. Unless you have low blood pressure, then
you might want to lay down.
Yeah, sure. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life.
Have your surrogate do it.
Tune in next week as we present information on what a Trump presidency will do to the national blood pressure on Morehead State Public Radio.